This is Americana Podcast, the 51st state. It's interesting how we as listeners can break musical genres down so that we can talk about them. An audience can take the general concept of what a certain type of music is and what it most generally sounds like, and from there, like a choose-your-own-adventure story, listeners can explore its many iterations. Music lovers can listen and debate anything, from the effects of technological advancements throughout the years to quote-unquote must-listen-to albums, and or the superiority of subgenre influences dictated by geographical location. It's a lot. And with the advent of the internet, those kinds of discussions are everywhere from top 10 lists to Reddit scholar theses. These discussions and schools of thought and their accessibility make for a great conversation, but it can also make learning about a genre incredibly daunting. Where do you even start? How do you know what to listen to, and what if you miss something? Sometimes the best way is to seek out someone who took the dive before and learn from them. On today's episode, recorded live from Americana Fest in Nashville, Tennessee, we speak with Chris Shiflett. Some of you may recognize him as the guitarist of the famed rock band The Foo Fighters, while others, or both, might know him from his podcast Walking the Floor with Chris Shiflett, a podcast in which Shiflett interviews fellow musicians. Shiflett was podcasting before it was cool, and has spoken with the likes of Merle Haggard, Yola, Tyler Childers, and so many more. In addition to his work in music journalism and his career in the Foo Fighters, Shiflett released his fourth record, Hard Lessons, in 2019. Shiflett's career and pursuits are a path which might be considered a great crash course in learning about music. His interviews are insightful and warm as he takes a casual yet curious approach with his guests. And his records merge his rock and roll musicianship with his affection for Bakersfield country. You can learn a lot whether listening to one, the other, or both. So join us as our host, Robert Earl Keane, speaks with Chris Shiflett about the Bakersfield beat, his tips on podcasting, and the effects of guitar in the Americana music world. I'm your producer, Clara Rose, and this is Americana Podcast, the 51st state. 7 nights a week, up to no good. Teenagers playing house in Hollywood. I tried my best to settle down, and you started dreaming about a wedding gown. Oh, mama, have you heard? I'm about as good as a liar's word. Oh, mama, have you heard? I'm about as good as a liar's word.
Welcome to Americana Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Earl Keane, recording live from Indo, Nashville at the Americana Fest. This is the annual Americana Fest. Today we're talking with Americana artist, guitar player extraordinaire, and master podcaster Chris Shiflett.
Yeah.
Yes,
master podcaster, elder statesman of the podcasting community.
I'm going to add that in the middle one, Chris. So, it's been a very busy week for you here at Americana Fest. So, I guess you played some shows?
Yeah, I've been playing all week, and I was, I was doing shows leading into it. So, I did about a week and a half of dates before we got here, and then just really hit the ground running. Some days, two shows in the same day, and then doing a bunch of interviews for my podcast, sort of sandwiched in between all that. So yeah, it's been pretty crazy, but I figure if I'm here, I it's better than sitting around.
No, absolutely, I understand. This isn't your first time here in Nashville, correct?
Last year was my first Americana Fest that I'd ever participated in, right. And it was interesting because at that point I had just made the record that I put out a few months ago, but I hadn't done any shows for it. And I'd done a bunch of shows just acoustic, just me and an acoustic guitar, because I knew it was going to take a minute for me to get my record out. But I want to keep the songs kind of in my head, so I didn't have to go like relearn my lyrics and that whole thing. Mm-hmm. But the Americana showcase that I did was the first like full band gig that I did with those songs, and I was able to corral like most of the people that played on my record. Mm-hmm. And I haven't listened to it since then, but I'm just going to guess it was pretty terrible on my part. Like, I think the band was great because they're a bunch of Nashville, you know, rockers that are, you know, the ringers, you know. But I'm sure that, you know, if I was to compare, like, this year's performance versus that year's, I think it was probably a little sketchy.
Right. Well, do you think, like, the artist is the harshest critic on their stuff? I mean, you talk to a lot of artists.
So, oh, yeah. Right? Without a doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, aren't you? It's like, how many times have you been on stage and in your head you're thinking, oh God, everybody hates me. And then you get off stage and everyone's like, that was the best show ever. You know, it's I think you get lost in it sometimes.
Absolutely. So what, and just in general, what is your favorite thing about Nashville?
Oh God, it's, you know, I have
a
lot
of your favorite things.
Well, I have a lot of good friends out here. It's funny because when I'm here, I'm usually working. You know, I've made my last couple records here and then come through on, you know, when I'm on tour and stuff. So I don't really get out much when I'm here. I don't go see live music. I don't really take advantage of what this town has in a lot of ways, but I do have a lot of good friends here. Mm-hmm. And so for sure that.
So
and the barbecue, you know, in bad. Yeah. Hot chicken or whatever, you know.
So have you ever considered leaving the Golden State and moving to the Volunteer State?
Well, I always say that when they put in a Kelly Slater wave pool out here, I'm in. Count me in. Let me know, guys.
Yeah.
I've never lived off the coast in my whole life ever, and I'm a total beach bum. So it would be hard for me to leave that. But I do like it here. I like coming out here and working and spending, you know, 2-3 weeks at a time and just being here.
Hey, baby, if it ain't just too late.
So you grew up in Santa Barbara, correct?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a Santa Barbara-related question?
Absolutely.
Did you see the movie 21st Century Women?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because, you know, that the guy that wrote that, he was actually my older brother, Steve-O's generation, and part of that early, like, punk rock, new wave kind of world that was happening. I was a little too young. I was listening to, like, Kiss records. I was, you know, just wasn't there yet and certainly wasn't going out, but I thought that they did such a good job of nailing the look and the vibe of that time, because they usually Hollywood screws that up, you know, with any kind of period piece thing. But God, that movie really felt like how I remember Santa Barbara in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, you know? Well, that's exactly what my next question was. Like, can go ahead and cancel that one. all right. So within the context of the movie, would you be and I know some of your upbringing and your past and your musical life. So, but I'm wondering if you would be a Black Flag fan or a Talking Heads fan.
Oh, I was definitely more of a Black Flag fan. Uh-huh. But it's funny, you know, the punk rock thing. I came to what I thought was late, you know, because I didn't get turned on. I remember when punk rock first started kind of happening, my older brother Mike, just out of curiosity, because, like, just for full background, like, you know, we were listening to Sabbath and Aerosmith and Ted Nugent, like that kind of thing in the 70s, you know, late 70s, and Stones and Deep Purple, all that kind of thing. So when punk rock came around, it was like, it seemed scary, and you heard about this crazy stuff happening over in England. And I remember my older brother went out and bought the Sex Pistols record and the first Clash record and brought them home. And we put them on. And the consensus in my house at the time was, this sucks. And so I didn't revisit that for a long time. And so, you know, I got turned on to Black Flag specifically in junior high at my buddy Luke's house because he had we had a little crew of friends and he had a skate ramp in his backyard and his house was like the epicenter of our little world. Mm-hmm. And I remember him playing My War by Black Flag and I started to hear that stuff. But like, you know, this was like already probably 84 or so, 83, 84, something like that. And it seemed like, I mean, I know Black Flag was still, there was still a version of Black Flag around at that point, but all the bands that I started getting into then from the punk rock side of things, they were all over, you know, Adolescence, TSOL, Social Distortion, you know, all that sort of era of punk rock stuff seemed like this cool thing that had happened a few years ago and you know, I missed it. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to think of now because that seems like a really long time ago, and so much has happened since then. And sure. Nobody would have ever thought like bands like Green Day and The Offspring and stuff that was going to someday happen. It just seemed like, you know, punk rock by the mid '80s was morphing into this like heavy metal punk rock crossover thing, like bands like DRI and stuff. And that stuff never appealed to me. I always liked the older stuff. And I went back and revisited that Pistols record and the Clash and stuff. And I started getting into that stuff like in high school. When, you know, where that was like 10 years after all those bands were happening, right. You know? And it really wasn't until around like when Bad Religion put out Suffer and NOFX started making good records around that same time that I've sort of got current with it, mm-hmm. You know? Social D put out Prison Bound and NOFX had S&M Airlines and like some of those records of that. When punk rock started to turn that direction, was when I got a little deeper into it. But I had like a really good friend of mine was a year or so older than me, and he had gone through all that stuff. And I remember one time him saying, like, anybody that gets a mohawk in 1987 is, you know, a kook or whatever. And that always stuck with me where I was like, and I never thought of myself as a punker. And I get so, like, everybody knows me from, you know, from some of the music that I did in the 90s that's, you know, punk rock stuff. And I love punk rock, don't get me wrong. Right. But I never felt like I was waving that flag because I felt like I had missed it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So make any threat you want. What can it take that you ain't got? Call your lawyer, call the cops. All you want is what you're not.
I understand that you were a hell of a soccer player that you came to a point where you had to decide between soccer and music. And my question would be, why did you have to make a decision? Why can't you bring both to the party?
Well, this is a really funny thing. This is a crazy rumor that's mm-hmm. become attached to me.
It's all over the damn internet.
I know. It's really like, I don't know who's... Okay, so let's really unpack this.
Okay, great.
I played... I don't know if you have AYSO out here in Texas or whatever, but where I grew up, everybody played AYSO. Right. It's like the low-level soccer. Right. You know, it's just what every kid does. And I played AYSO until about sixth grade, and then not coincidentally, in sixth grade, I picked up a guitar. And then I quit playing soccer. And that was the end of my soccer life until many, many years later. And as an adult, like in my 20s, I started playing in like pickup games and stuff like that. And I think that this rumor is really funny. There's no truth to it whatsoever. Like I never played at a high level. Right. I was never a competitive soccer. Like, and so I just imagine all the guys that I play in like adult league stuff with, because I'm like the worst. I think these teams just let me on because I'm in the Foo Fighters. It's like I get cutie points, you know what I mean, for that. Because I'm not great. And I just imagine some of the guys I play with hearing that rumor and just going, what? Yeah. Professional? That dude was never going to be a professional soccer player, ever. And I also think how funny it would be, because knowing how I was when I was 18, and I assumed that would be about the age where you'd have to make a choice like that, I was not leading an athlete's life.
Right.
I'll just put it that way.
Not in the steroids sort of way.
Right. Well, yeah, actually, yeah, maybe I was leading an athlete's life, come to think of it.
But you can't say that I'm a fool. I ain't spent a lot of time living by the golden rule. But don't you try to change me, even if you think you can. Cause I'm a womanist eating, double dealing, guitar picking man.
Okay, so let's talk about Chris Shiflett and the Dead Peasant.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you played with the two records,
yeah,
correct? And
yeah.
And now these were these self-produced records?
They were self-produced. The first one was really it was just me and my buddy Lou, mm-hmm, who's the house engineer at Foo Fighters studio, mm-hmm, out in Los Angeles. He's like, you know, he's at the studio all the time, and he's a really good drummer. Mm-hmm. And he grew up actually out here, not too far away in Knoxville, mm-hmm, and was, you know, and you know, grew up listening to Dwight Yoakam and stuff like that. So he had a lot of those reference points, as well as like a lot of the sort of goofy heavy metal stuff that I grew up listening to. But so Lou's a good friend of mine. And that first record I did as the Dead Peasants, I didn't have a band, but I didn't want to just call it Chris Shiflett. I wasn't comfortable, mm-hmm, doing that. I wanted to make it seem like it was a band or something. So, but it was really just me and Lou, mm-hmm, in our studio. And it was the first time I'd written a bunch of songs that were kind of like more acoustic-y based. And mm-hmm, I brought in Greg Lease to play steel on it.
Another question. Well, okay, throw that one away. Okay. No. The steel is fantastic,
yes,
on that. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, have you ever worked with Greg before? Like, he's like a
master. I'm just a fan.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And we spent as much or more time sitting in the studio with him going, you know, tell me what it was like to see the birds at the Troubadour, you know. so you saw, you know, Graham Parsons, cool, tell me about that, you know. That guy's got endless stories. But so that was the first time I ever kind of tried to make music that was like some of the stuff that I was listening to, you know. Because mm-hmm, I'd always was played more heavy rock stuff, mm-hmm, and punk rock stuff, and big loud stuff. And it was a real learning experience. But then, you know, when I went to go do some shows around that, I had to put a band together,
right?
And that sort of evolved into the second record we did,
right?
And really, the origins of the second record, it's funny because, like I said, that first record was really like the first time I ever tried to play, you know, something, uh-huh, that was a different dynamic. Uh-huh. And it was really hard. Like, I didn't get why it was sounded so terrible. I'm like, I wrote these goddamn songs, why can't I play them?
Yeah.
But it was weird. It took my ear a little getting used to.
Just the cadence and the tone, and that kind of thing.
Not having a big wall of distortion.
Right.
Okay. Not playing through a Les Paul. Right. You know, playing through a Tele with a single coil. Through a little combo amp. Uh-huh. And what that does, and you know, it's a different animal.
Yeah.
So that took a minute, and I was actually down in Austin and had a night off, and I don't know. Have you ever gone and seen that at the Continental on Sunday nights?
Red Bogart.
Yes.
Yes.
Hay Bale.
Right, Hay Bale. Yeah.
So I was watching Hay Bale one night, and it like dawned on me. I was like, I need to do this for a while.
Uh-huh.
I'm gonna just go home and I'm gonna do this, uh-huh, for a while. And so when we got together when I had a break and I started doing some Dead Peasants shows, we just learned like all our favorite honky tonk songs,
uh-huh,
and that was like a hoot. And I did that for a couple of years, mm-hmm, and made a. That was the second record.
How you ended up doing Papa Top.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, it is like when I was really just exploring a lot of that music for the first time, because it's not what I grew up with. And I kind of came to alt country and country music and Americana and all that stuff through like the Stones, but also in a big way through Sunvolt and Uncle Tupelo and that thing, you know what I mean? Was sort of, and Steve Earle and all those type of artists. Right. So I was really just digging into a lot of that stuff, and like my friend Marty that was playing steel with me would be like, oh, if you like that song, you gotta check out this song, and you know, here, listen to this. And then my buddy Mitch Marine would be like, oh, you like that, check this out, you know, kind of thing. And that's how that second record kind of happened.
Yeah.
And we just went out and played shows like that, you know, for a few years.
The origin of the Dead Peasants itself, there's a story behind that.
Well, it's not a particularly good one. They're the first, I was going to call it. I had another name in Spanish that meant like, I forget what the
Los
name was.
Los Paisanos Muertos?
How'd you, were you in the band, man? No, it was something, it was like, I think it was the word peasant in Spanish, and I'm blanking on it now, but I looked online and there was already a band called that. And I'm like, okay, well, I can't do that. And around that time, I had seen that Michael Moore movie, Sicko. And there was that part in Sicko that stuck with me that I thought was crazy, where the employers were taking out life insurance policies on their employees without their knowledge so that when they died, they would collect on them. And those policies were referred to as dead peasant policies. So that's where that just stuck in my head. I don't know.
I think it has a ring to it.
Yeah. And little did my bandmates know, but I had policies going on all of it. I was rooting for their imminent death.
Here, you take that van. The older van.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah, you don't need that thing grounded. Come on. Pop a top again. I think I'll have another round. Set him up, my friend. And I'll be gone. And you can let some other fool sit down.
So I'd like to move to your podcast a little bit before we go to the records that you worked on with Dave Cobb.
Yeah.
Okay. So I understand that you started this podcast in an effort to shed some light on the Bakersfield sound. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was the initial idea, and it was around when I did that, so the second Dead Peasants record. It was actually an idea from one of the guys at our label.
Right.
And this was around 2013. And he had an idea. He's like, you should start a podcast. You could promote your record through it. And so I went, great. And then I thought, well, what should it be? And I thought, oh, I'll try to get an interview with as many of the Bakersfield Sound, you know, folks that were around that scene. And so I wound up, I interviewed Red Simpson. And that was pretty much it. That was all that was left. Yeah. So I quickly had to figure out another way to go. So I just started calling people I could get to, you know, people in my phone book. I interviewed like my buddy, the guitar player, you know, Nick from the Hives, and I had 1 degree of separation from John Doe. So I just cold called him and he agreed to do it. And, and it just kept going. And yeah, it was like in those early days, I still don't feel like I like know what I'm doing exactly, but I'm definitely more comfortable with it.
Right.
I used to fall all over myself in the interviews, and I would get so nervous, and I would stumble, and then I would go back and I would re-record my question because it was so bad, you know. And I'd do like a lot of editing, and then I did a few of them, and I just went, yeah, whatever, I don't care. I'm comfortable with being inarticulate.
I think a lot of us are in this music/entertainment business so we can sort of rewrite our history anyway, right?
Totally.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Let's get this straight. I didn't really say that.
Yeah. First, I am not a professional soccer player.
So I've always been a fan of, you know, country music, but I've always heard a distinct difference between California country music and Nashville country music.
Sure.
Do you consider a difference there?
Yeah, and it's interesting from this distance if we're talking, because you know there's a couple different phases of that. There's certainly like the Topanga Canyon, you know, Laurel Canyon thing that is a little bit different, which I think had ultimately, I think all the like the Eagles were probably a bigger influence on Nashville than anything that came on out of the West Coast. But when I think of West Coast country, you know, of course I'm thinking of Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and all the stuff that came out of that scene. And it's funny now, like, because the world has changed so much, right? And so you listen to Buck Owens' record from 1967, it doesn't sound radical. It doesn't sound like hard country or whatever they call it, you know what I mean?
Sure.
You don't really even notice that there aren't a bunch of string sections and millions of harmony layers and stuff. It just sounds, you know, I love it, but it sounds tame compared to, you know, Metallica or something that's come after it, you know? But yeah, definitely. If you go back and compare sort of what was coming out of Nashville at that time, and I love the Nashville stuff too. I mean, it's great. I love country politan style country music, but but I think, I don't know, my heart leans a little Bakersfield.
Oh, and I do it all again. Just wake up in the same old bed. Take it all right on the chin.
I've spoken to a variety of artists, from Dwight Yoakam to Brad Paisley to Merle Haggard and to Tyler Childers. And you were podcasting before podcasting was cool. I want to know your secret, Chris. Tell me about how you get a fresh response from people. I'm trying to dig into some of your magic here so I can borrow it. Okay. Okay. So your style, has it, I mean, how's it evolved, and what do you think, how do you get people to talk to you in a really open way?
Well, one of the things that was like a guiding light when I first started it, because I'm a musician myself and have gone on promo tours and sit and, get interviewed by people, I've noticed over the years that you pretty much only get asked about 5 or 10 questions ever, and that's it.
Right.
And every interview is the same thing, over and over and over again.
Right.
And you know, not to bag on journalists, but it just always feels really kind of lazy. You know what I mean? It's like every time I'm interviewed by a regular journalist, I'm always like, everybody knows this. Or like, why are you bothering to ask me what my favorite song to play live is or whatever? You know what I mean? Those kind of questions. So I wanted to try my, I mean, obviously some things you got to ask people about. You know, there's just some things that you got to go to that they've probably answered 10,000 times. But I wanted to ask them, I wanted it to be conversational, and I wanted to ask them things that maybe they don't get to talk about. Because you know how it is. Usually interviews are pretty short. And the joy of podcasting is that you just have a relaxed conversation. Right. And it's not like, you know, bam, 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 bam. You know, here's my 5 things I got to hammer you with real quick, you know.
Right. Are there certain themes that you return to?
I like to hear about where people grew up, why they got into it, you know. I like to get into the weeds on some gear. You know, people love to hear about gear. Right. I don't know why, but they do. And I like to hear about gear.
Right.
And songwriting. You know, I like to hear how other people do it.
Yeah.
These are all subjects we're going to cover in about 40 minutes when I interview
you. I can't wait. Are there themes that you avoid?
Depending on the guest. I'm not necessarily themes I avoid. I try to, if somebody, you know, has something, like I try not to go too lowball.
So when you're in a bind in an interview like I am right now, what is your Hail Mary pass?
Oh, man. I don't know if I have one. Sometimes you just sputter, you know, because you know it is like you're doing this too. It's like sometimes a conversation goes in a completely different direction, and you've got your questions that you sort of worked up, and you're like, well, how the heck do I get it back to here?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And then sometimes you interview somebody, you can tell they don't necessarily want to talk about something that, you know, 9 of your 10 questions were about.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I mean, that's really been a fascinating thing, because I've found, especially like when I talk to Merle Haggard or somebody, guys of that, men and women of that generation.
And he was a tough interviewer.
No, he wasn't. He was known to be a tough interviewer.
Right, right.
He could not have been more gracious.
Really?
With me. It was he almost had like a proud grandpa vibe.
Yeah.
Like, so you're in a band, huh?
Yeah. Oh, good.
That's great. You guys doing okay? Yeah. Way to go. You know, he kind of had that that kind of feel to it, which is great. It was cool.
So how has your podcast made you think about music since you started it?
Well, I get turned on to a lot of music by doing it, from like people, artists that I'm not familiar with necessarily before I interview them. And part of my process for getting ready to interview somebody is listening to their catalog, you know, which is... it's a lot easier when somebody has one record than, you know, somebody that has 8 million records. so I just wind up, you know, just listening to a lot of, getting turned on to stuff all the time.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I find, because I always ask people about songwriting, and I think it's interesting to hear other people do what they do, but nobody ever has a concise answer. Like, you know, there's no, here's how you write a song that really, you know.
Right.
But I like hearing, you know, just... like people, you know, hearing how they do it.
I am a stone dropped 100 stories. I'm alone if I'm not with you.
So now we can return to your records, your most recent records, and these are under your name, Chris Shiflett.
Yeah,
Chris Shiflett, right?
Well, when I did the Dead Peasants thing, you know, it didn't take me long to figure out, like, I'm, because you know, being like at the Foo Fighters is full time. You know, it's not a job; it's like full time life. You know,
right?
That we work a lot, and I can't really keep a band together.
Sure.
You know, so most of the Dead Peasants were just my buddies
right
back home. But it's like, you know, I go away for a year and I come home, and then people have other things going on. So it was just always changing members and changing around, and can't really keep it together. So I just gave up trying at a certain point, and I just figured I'll just stick my name on it. And then there's be less of that thing like, what happened to all your band? You know?
So the first record you did like that, and that you produced with Dave Cobb, was West Coast Town.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that song, what's interesting to me about that song is it's a really great California take on sort of a theme that goes through like Mid-South and Nashville country music all the time.
Sure.
And I don't know many, like, this is my town and we're kicking some ass and all that sort of stuff
right.
that comes out of California. Yeah. It's not like something that, I mean, I think it was really cool that you pulled that off in that,
well,
in that way.
It's interesting, you know, like,
and you're talking about Santa Barbara, right?
Oh, yeah, very much. Okay. Yeah. And
so I this mean, is the darker side of Santa Barbara in some ways?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
or the tougher side,
well,
maybe.
Well, Santa Barbara, everybody knows Santa Barbara is from the soap opera or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But I think the time that I grew up there, I think that time in California, the 70s into the 80s, was a strange time. I don't see my own children having a similar childhood.
Right.
But you have to remember, like, that was it was a weird period of time in the world where, like, my parents' generation were really on top of it. My parents' generation, they were way more hands-off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is my theory. I'm no sociologist, but this is how I've put it all together, you know? But so they were way more hands-off, and Santa Barbara and every California beach town of that era, I think, had a similar thing where, you know, people, working class families weren't priced out yet. You know, we all lived in the same, my mom, I mean, I don't know, maybe we're lower middle class or something. I don't know exactly where we slotted in there. My mom was a probation officer. But our neighborhood was real mixed, you know, and it was just like a working class neighborhood in Santa Barbara. And then you have like the extreme wealth of Montecito sitting right on top of you.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't send their kids to private schools to the same extent that they do now. So all the kids were together, and the parents weren't looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I look back on it, and I think it's just this crazy period of time when, you know, this is way after the 60s now, and things have kind of unraveled, you know? And there's a lot of drugs around, and there's that post-hippie burnout thing around, and there's punk rock around, and there's heavy metal, and there's a lot of crazy shit. And it was like, I look at some of the guys, and I want to make it clear, like that line in that song that we don't fuck around or whatever, I took that from I'll tell you that story in a minute, but I don't mean that so much as like, I'm not referring to myself, as I'm referring to all the characters that I remember being around, and I think of it in the sense of like, God, I hope my kids don't hang around with motherfuckers like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. I can't believe my mom like knew all those people from probation. And like,
nice.
You know what I mean?
Oh, wow.
So it was just a funny time. It was weird and violent and druggy and boozy and wild and really, really fun.
Right.
But like most of those people are dead now.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And it's weird. It's almost like there's this crazy lost generation of kids. And like a lot of those folks that were the wildest, like they were smart and charismatic. That was just pointed in the wrong direction.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you know, you think of some of these guys that I grew up with that could have like gone on to do great things and just wound up expiring, you know, young. It's just a weird, weird time. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's like that now as much.
Right.
I mean, maybe it's a different set of problems. I don't know. But that particular period was just wild California beach town life.
I walked home all the way from East Beach with an oil spill sticking to my feet, to that little house on Salinas Street, go right. rocks in the creek, my brothers and me. Yeah, Mom held it down on a county wage. Clothes on the back, some food on our plates. Every Saturday night, mariachi's played. And I listen through the window to the lowrider sway. Yeah, I grew up in a West Coast town. Back before they chased the working class out. You know we don't fuck around where I grew up. In a West Coast town.
We're going to take a quick break. And we'll be back with our interview with Chris Shiflett shortly. At Americana Podcast, it is our goal to define and explore the idea and extensions of Americana music. With help from our friend and personal vanguard of all things found on a Soundwave, Will Vogt, this is Will's Pick. Based in Asheville, North Carolina, Christopher Paul Stelling is a singer-songwriter who has released four well-received albums. Stelling's 2012 debut, Songs of Praise and Scorn, was recorded in a 200-year-old funeral home in Kentucky. It received favorable reviews from critics, and after it was released, he toured the country and Europe extensively. Burned out by the constant touring and suddenly sober, he was back in Asheville trying to figure out his next move when he got a call from the one and only Ben Harper, who wanted to produce his next album. The result of that collaboration is Best of Luck. The album expands on Stelling's songwriting and singing talents and feels like a step forward in his music. Will's pick in the album is Trouble Don't Follow Me. Very much in the spirit of His Golden Messenger, the song has a rolling groove and catchy lyrics, and is a must hear for anybody interested in contemporary singer-songwriters today.
So you made both of these records in Nashville, Hard Lessons, Hard Lessons and West Coast Town. You made both those records. And also coming from a rock and roll background, I always hear with rock and rollers that they go in with bits and pieces of songs and then they turn on all the stuff and they figure it out in the studio. Even the, you know, even this is reflected in movies a lot of times,
sure.
You know. And whereas I find country people kind of go in with the songs written, I'm kind of wondering about you. How did you go in?
Well, it's the way that Dave Cobb has a process, you know, that he does. And so the first time that I went in and worked with him, you know, I hardly even knew him. I'd only met him once and had a couple of phone conversations with him. So even though he told me, like, don't make demos. Uh-huh. I made a lot of demos.
Right.
I worked it out. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I thought about what the bass part would be doing and what should the drums be doing. I did all that. Because that's, you know, when I go in and work, that's usually how I do it. Just because of, you know, budget and time consideration.
Sure.
Which is very different from, like, a Foo Fighter record.
Right.
We go in with the songs. Usually, like, Dave's an interesting writer in that way. Like, he'll get the songs are pretty together before we start. But they're not done. You know, and usually, like, there's no vocal or anything yet on them, and then we start making the record, and then things come together. But, you know, a big successful band has a budget, you know, and a little, and my records don't, you know, they're you know, they're constrained a little by, you know, it's, you have a finite time. So the first time I went in, I really worked everything out, but I quickly realized once I got in there that we're going to throw most of that out the window. You know, because I went in there, just me. I didn't bring a band. Dave got his, you know, team of dudes to play on it, and he plays on it. And then we all sit there in a room together and track it live, and like, ideas are flying around, and it changes a lot. Uh-huh. And so when I got ready to do the second record, I was touring a lot with Foos, so I was writing on the road. But I intentionally didn't go in with everything really fleshed out. What I wanted to make sure I had was all the words, you know, the lyrics were written, the melodies were together, and I had the chords, and I just made some very loose reference recordings, really just for me, just to know that I had the songs, because I didn't want to be in the studio. I want to be in the studio working on the arrangement and getting the take.
Right.
I don't want to be in the studio going like, oh, I got to complete that second verse, man, what am I going to say, you know what I mean? So I want to make sure I had all that, because we, you know, especially with Cobb, you always wind up cutting a lot anyway. So I like to go in with too much.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, then you can just get a good take and get a good performance. And
right.
And that's that.
Okay. So what is on the recording horizon for Chris Shiflett?
The recording horizon, well, we're going to make a new Foo Fighter record at some point here. Not exactly sure when. But as far as me, I'm not sure. You know, I just started writing a bunch of new songs. I've been kind of chipping away at that. I'm not sure when. Yeah, I think I got a busy year or two ahead of me.
Okay.
We'll see.
I know what you're feeling. You're hurting and proud. Don't want no one seeing your tears hit the ground. So welcome to your first heartache. Welcome to your first broken bow. Shakes you like an earthquake. Welcome to your, welcome to your first heartache.
The lighter side, Chris, is just some easier sort of your favorite drive in California.
My favorite drive?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, definitely driving from my house in L.A. up to Santa Barbara.
Okay.
Yeah, because you drive up PCH, and then you got to go through Ventura, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And then that, but that stretch between Ventura and Santa Barbara, I just love.
All right.
The coast right there.
What was the last record you heard that had a resounding impact on you?
Ooh, had a resounding impact on me. I mean, there's a lot of good music. I remember when I was recording West Coast Town, Cobb had just made that Laurie McKenna record. What's it called? Bird and the Rifle? Rifle and the Bird?
Yeah, Bird and the Rifle.
Yeah. And that just, like, hit me in my my sweet spot.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
What is the last instrument you purchased?
Last instrument I purchased? Ooh, God, what was the last instrument I purchased? I actually sold a ton of guitars.
Really?
About a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I took all the money. I had all these guitars at our studio that I just wasn't using. And I took all the money. I just sold 20 guitars and turned it into one guitar.
Wow.
And it was, and it is a 57 gold top that somebody had removed.
God's own guitar.
Right. Yeah. Somebody had removed the gold. I never bought one of those kind of guitars before, and I was like, I'm not going to cut the check. And it's just like, I can't explain that to my wife, you know.
Right, sure.
Sorry, we're not going to get, we're not, you know, paying for the kids' school this year because I needed that guitar. Right. So I just sold a bunch and got that, and it's beautiful. Best guitar ever.
What is your favorite way to wind down after a show? Your show or Foo Fighters show?
Yeah, I'm pretty mellow, you know. I don't drink anymore, And my way of winding, I just go back to my hotel room, take a nice hot shower, curl up in bed with a good book.
That's about it. What are you reading?
I just read that Stevie Ray Vaughan book that came out.
I think in the bookstore.
Yeah, it's good because it's, you know, it's one of those books that's like a, what do you call it, like an oral history or whatever. It's just a bunch of different people that knew him. And so it was pretty interesting. And then I interviewed Delbert McClinton a couple days ago, and I was given a copy of his book, so I just started that.
Delbert's awesome.
Yeah.
Here at Americana Podcast, it is our goal to define, expand, and explore the genre of Americana music. First, I'd like to ask, as a music journalist of sorts, how do you define Americana music?
Yeah, that's a good question. To me, Americana is like slowly becoming where all the guitar-based music is winding up.
Ah,
you know, because
nice.
Like you used to have alt country, you know, in the 90s it was called alt country. And before that it was maybe progressive country or something. Sure. I don't know. But now I think Americana goes way further out than mm-hmm. that. Americana could be blues or, mm-hmm. you know, any kind of roots music, really. Yeah. You know what I mean? And certainly all the alt country stuff and all the sort of different versions of that. So I think it's, and then you have like a band like, you know, a lot of like what I hear as being just rock and roll bands get called Americana.
Right.
You know, I mean, my new record's pretty rock and roll, but it gets called Americana too.
Do you consider yourself Americana artist?
I mean, I suppose, you know, it's funny. It really depends. Like, I don't really worry about it too much because I don't want to like ever get into some kind of headspace where I'm like, oh, I can't do that. That's not Americana. You know what I mean? But it's funny, like rock and roll people think I make country records. Uh-huh. And country people think I make cowpunk records or something. You know what I mean? It's like, sure. I think it really depends on sort of where you're coming from with it. I like to think of my records as like somewhere between. It's like the Stones and Buck Owens and Social Distortion all got together and had a baby. And that was me.
We're down to our lightning round, Chris. Here we go.
Oh, boy.
All right. These are just either or, you know, just pick one, okay? All right. So in the world of soccer, Argentina or Brazil?
Oh, Argentina, no doubt.
Manchester United or Manchester City?
Hate them both. I'm Arsenal. I'm Arsenal to the bone.
All right. Cricket or Australian football?
Aussie rules all day.
All right, fantastic. Highway 1 or Highway 5?
Oh, Highway 1.
Okay.
Yeah, no doubt.
The movie Pulp Fiction or the movie The Player?
Ooh, I'd go with Pulp Fiction.
Okay. Yeah. Jimi Hendrix or Eric Clapton?
Hendrix.
All right.
Come on.
Come on. The song The Streets of Bakersfield or the song The Girl with the Faraway Eyes?
Oh, God, you're killing me. That's a tough one. I mean, really, I grew up with The Girl with the Faraway Eyes, but I do love Streets of Bakersfield.
Yeah, well, yeah. I recommend watching the video of A Girl with the Faraway Eyes.
Okay.
Okay. Red Rocks or the Hollywood Bowl?
Ooh. I've never played the Hollywood Bowl, but I have played Red Rocks.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to play the Hollywood Bowl, but I think they make you keep it too quiet. Yeah. I don't know.
That's what
I've heard.
Touring in a minivan or in a private jet?
I've done them both, and I'm here to tell you the private jet's a lot nicer. A lot.
Last one of the lightning round, and then we have one more question. Friday, 9 a.m. in July on the 405 with a dead stereo and a broken air conditioner or a meet and greet?
The 405's not so bad.
All right. Here at Americana Podcast, we feel like it's a crime that they named a beautiful instrument, this organ that they call the B3. We want to find a new name for the B3.
Mm.
Can you suggest one or share one with us?
A new name for the B3?
Yeah.
The John Lord box.
Nice.
For those of you who don't know, that's the Deep Purple's.
Oh, right.
B3 player.
Fantastic.
Legend.
Fantastic.
Legend.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Robert Earl Keen. You've been listening to Americana Podcast, and we've been talking with Chris Shiflett today. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you down the road.
Yeah.
This time, we would like to thank the team at Richland Group, Indo Nashville, Americana Fest, the Walking the Floor team, and our guest, Chris Shiflett. We would also like to thank our host, Robert Earl Keen. Americana Podcast is brought to you by Keen Productions, edited and produced by Clara Rose, mastered by Pat Mansky, with original music by Kim Warner. Until next time, let the music play.